Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro. And this week, my guest is Developer Community Manager Chuck Von Rosspach. Chuck, good afternoon. Thanks for being on the show.
Hey, good afternoon to you, too. Thank you for having me.
Hey, it's great to have you on the show. I got to know you when I was at Apple and you were at Apple. And I've been watching all the cool things that you've been doing ever since. And so we're going to talk about that.
Cool.
But you joined Apple in 1989, you told me before. What were you doing before that?
Well, I actually moved to Silicon Valley in 1982, which is probably before most of your audience was born. And I did a couple of startups, neither of which exist today. And I ended up at Sun Microsystems.
Oh, cool. One of my favorite companies.
You may have heard of.
I had Suns on my desk for most of my career.
Yeah. And so I got into their tech support organization. And I was employee 1215. And we were working with the last of the Sun 2s and the first of the Sun 3s when I joined them.
Those were awesome machines. Was that the CDE era or was that pre-CDE?
It was CDE moving into Sun Windows, moving towards the news windowing system down the road.
Okay.
So my tenure at Sun was about the Sun 260 through the 350, which was one of my favorite boxes of all times. And then the last one I worked on was the first of Sun Spark chips, the Sun 4260, which I helped nurse out the door. And that was as Sun was starting to move into SunOS 4.0, which was renamed Solaris.
Yeah. For the listeners, if you were a technical professional in aerospace or research or scientist in the 80s, you had early 90s. We all had these fabulous workstations, Unix workstations. It could have been from IBM with AIX. It could have been a Sun workstation. It could have been an SGI workstation with Irix. They all had these fabulous Unix operating systems, and they were, geez, expensive, but they were a joy. And they kind of embarrassed what was going on with the personal computers at the time. They were 10 times faster, at least, and 10 times more expensive. But if you had one on your desk, you could do some serious engineering. So anyway, that was cool. So how did you land the job at Apple? Is it, that probably thanks to the Sun work, right?
And because of the Sun work. And my boss actually went to Apple, and I went over with him. And we founded what was known as the Direct Response Center, which was Apple's first paid technical support organization. And that initially was five of us who were supporting AUX, which was Apple's 68,000 Unix system. And as it turned out, we ended up supporting a lot of other things because we were set up to handle the kind of products that call your dealer simply wouldn't work with. So I got my hands on a bunch of weird Apple attempts to move into the enterprise, including like 3270 boards and stuff like that, but also some of their database middleware stuff. And I ended up doing both Unix support and becoming kind of a database specialist for the organization over time.
AUX was the deep, deep father of Rhapsody and then Mac OS X. It was BSD Unix running on a 68K. I had it running on a Quadra 700 when I was at the Oak Ridge National Lab, and it was awesome. We were all used to the System 6, System 7, simple-minded stuff. And when I put this AUX system on my Quadra 700, I thought, wow, this is grown-up stuff. This is really serious. I was so proud of Apple for doing that.
Yeah, it was a great team and it was a great product. They had it when Apple made the transition to PowerPC, they had it running on PowerPC, but the project ended up being killed for political reasons. So we never saw it, and I don't think that until we got to Mac OS X, Apple really had a Unix product as good as AUX was.
It was amazing. One of the things that I didn't like about it was that you were rev locked into system 7.0.1 or something like that, and you couldn't update as system 7 evolved. You couldn't, you had to have some sort of a dual boot system or something so that you could stay up to date with the latest version of system 7. But in AUX, you couldn't easily update the system 7 subsystem in there, and that made it kind of annoying. Do you remember why that was? I'm curious.
No, I don't. That's been a long time.
Anyway, it was an amazing system. Then later, you became also involved with this Apple Network Server, which was also kind of a geeky Unix thing.
Yeah, I transitioned out of tech support, and I ended up in the Apple Server Marketing Group, my first run as a marketing nerd, where I call the not 50 line, the 6150, 8150, 9150 class machines came out of. And then we went off and we did this Apple Network Server, which was this big Maytag washer with redundant everything. And
it wasn't that big. It was more like a one cubic foot refrigerator, a little apartment refrigerator.
Yeah, it was a dorm refrigerator.
Yeah.
And it had hot swappable drives, and it had redundant power supplies, and it had a lot of power. And it never ran Mac OS. It ran AIX, because at that point, Spindler had made deals with IBM. And so we were doing partnerships on technology with IBM. So we had done away with the old versions of whatever we were doing, and now we were doing AIX, which actually is a pretty nice version of Unix.
Didn't the AIX network server also run System 7, or am I mistaken?
The network server was originally designed to run, of all things, Windows NT. And that there's a whole story there, which once the lawyers die of old age, maybe I'll tell. But it was originally going to run Windows 8 NT, and then Michael Spindler, who, if you remember, was very vehemently anti-Microsoft, found out, and that ended that idea. We could not get approval from the Mac OS systems group to release a product for Mac OS on that box, because we weren't part of that organization, and they wouldn't give us the code. So we ended up going with AIX and shipping it as an enterprise data center AIX box. And the number one customer for that box was actually Apple itself. And that machine pretty much ran Apple's data center for a number of years.
Was it embraced by scientists and engineers? Did you sell any to like NASA? Just curious.
Not really. The problem with that machine was it wasn't really rack mountable, and it was quite expensive because they had put in all the features that when they did focus groups, they were told that they wanted. Mm-hmm. And when we came back with the box and said, here's the box you told us you wanted, they said, it's great, except it's not rack mountable and it's too expensive.
How much was it at the time?
$6,000 to $7,000. Mm. At the baseline, and people were like, if it was rack mountable in 4,000, maybe.
For the listeners, here's what was happening at that time. Microsoft had to come out with Windows NT about that time, and it was embarrassing Apple System 7, which didn't have preemptive multitasking, memory protection, and login credentials, and login logs, and so on. And I was part of a group that was, I was with Lockheed Martin at the time, trying to convince Apple to step it up and provide these enterprise features in their Mac operating system. And they didn't seem to have any interest in that. But what was happening was is that Microsoft simultaneously saw an opportunity with Windows NT, which had all those grown-up things, the credentials. It was based on VMS, and it had preemptive multitasking and a kernel and all those good things that enterprise wanted. And you could put it on PC hardware. And boy, yeah. Did that take the wind out of those workstations, which were $10,000 at the time. So that was the beginning of the end of the workstations. Anyway, that's kind of an aside.
And to a degree, that's what killed companies like SGI.
Right.
Because SGI was a great company until standard hardware was good enough that you could do 3D rendering on it. And NT ate Apple's lunch and deserved to.
Mm-hmm.
And I spent the first half of my life at Apple effectively dealing with attempts to break into the enterprise, and not one of them worked because Apple really didn't understand it.
No, they didn't. I remember talking to a vice president at WWDC about, you know, having a secure logon and authentication. Who's on this machine? What are they doing? And he just shrugged and said, third-party opportunity.
So. Yeah. Yeah, that's so Apple at that time.
But from time to time, we've seen Apple, you know, do glorious things. With AUX and then this network server and then trying to work with IBM. There was always that sort of Apple market independence, but there was also that need to, you know, work with the enterprise. I just posted a show with the legendary Jean-Louis Gasset, and he talked about how that when the first Mac came out, they were up against the IBM PC-AT, which was kicking butt. And it had Culver, and it had a subsystem in assembly language, and it had a hard disk. And he was being pressured to, you know, take the Mac up against this kind of IBM PC-AT machine. And he said, I didn't want to stand in front of a firing squad.
Yeah. It was not a good time for Apple, and there were very good reasons why they effectively lost the PC war to Microsoft and IBM, and a lot of them were self-inflicted wounds of a bit of naivete, a bit of arrogance, and a bit of just kind of assuming that they were always going to be better. And I would say if you take a look at the Macintosh Performa lines at that time, that we were not turning out hardware that was either reliable or better than what you could get over on the Intel side.
Mm-hmm.
And it almost killed the company.
It did. And then there was the channel stuffing, too.
Oh, yeah. Right. We had some interesting organizational problems.
Channel stuffing is when you push stuff out and you ship it to stores who don't want it. And then they send it back unsold. And then you write it off as a tax break. And you get awards for how many items you shipped. But the company's going broke because you didn't sell anything.
Yeah, and that was a sales organization that was organized around making sure everybody got their quarterly quotas,
yeah,
and not caring about the company itself. And
yeah,
that was something that I think ultimately killed Spindler as CEO, and was something that Gil Amelio was unable to fix either, even though he tried. And it wasn't until Steve showed up and started putting a few heads on pikes outside of Infinite Loop One that they were able to get some of those big organizational fiefdom problems under control.
Before we go on, I want to back up just a little bit. So you joined in 89. That was right after Steve left in 85, and Jean-Louis Gasset took over the Mac division.
Correct.
How long was Jean-Louis there? Do you remember?
Oh, I showed up midway through Scully's regime, and Jean-Louis...
I think Jean-Louis got fired by Scully at one point.
Yeah. He was there for a while, because I actually made it to one of his infamous Christmas parties. And got to sit in the audience and listen to Ella Fitzgerald sing, and that was absolutely awesome.
Where did he hold these parties?
That was at the San Jose Convention Center.
Oh, that's where the WWDC used to be before Apple outgrew it.
Correct. And it actually had, I believe, five bands. including the headliner, and he basically orchestrated this big show for a few thousand people as Apple Engineering Christmas Party. And it was just, that was like the second to last one they did before finances kind of rolled that one in. And I don't remember what year it was, to be honest.
I remember. I remember there was a WWDC with a special event for the Mac. For the Apple Masters, and I got to see Gregory Hines and Herbie Hancock perform together, improvisational. That was an awesome experience.
Yeah, no, those were really great events.
Yeah. Any other stories about Mr. Gesse that you want to tell?
The only real time that I interacted with John Louie, and he won't remember this, but I had just... There was a computer store called Computerware in Palo Alto, and that was basically where you could go and get Mac stuff. And I actually went there to buy my first ever hard drive, which was a whole 10 megabytes. And as I'm walking out of the store with my box with my 10 megabyte hard drive, which is going to plug into the floppy port of my Mac Plus, I think it was, I actually run into John Louie as he's walking into the store, and he sees me with the box, and he just kind of smiles and pats me on the shoulder, and we walk by. And that's kind of my personal life with John Louie.
Yeah, the show with him was fascinating. He had an illustrious career, and I really enjoyed interviewing him, hearing about all the crazy things that he's done. Hey, guess what? It's time for a break. How about if we go off and listen to Kelly for a second, and then we'll come back and we'll talk about more the days of Amelio and Spindler, and then we'll get into some Apple stuff. How's that?
Sounds good to me.
Okay. Folks, we'll be back in 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Hello there, all you fabulous background mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage, where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
Thanks, Kelly. I'm talking to Chuck von Rosbach. So we mentioned Spindler a little while ago. I want to go back and talk about Michael Spindler, because there was a bit of CEO chaos about that time. After John Sculley left, we had a CEO named Michael Spindler. My first reaction to him was when I showed up at a WWDC and he gave the keynote on the big screen video from Germany. And because he had more important things to do than present to the developers in person. And so that was my first reaction to him. And he was not one of the most illustrious Apple CEOs, Michael Spindler.
No. Spindler was an unmitigated disaster.
Yes.
Sorry if I'm going to sugarcoat this a little bit, but he was not a nice person. He was not a good CEO. He was arrogant. He was not technical, didn't want to be. And he had a tendency to order people around rather than lead them. And a good chunk of Apple tried to ignore him as much as possible.
I'm told he tried to sell Apple. That was his only role in life, he felt, was to position Apple, because it was having difficulties in those days. Windows was coming along with its graphical interface. Microsoft was giving Apple a really hard time in the enterprise. Apple had not yet recognized the need for a modern Unix-like operating system, and maybe there was no way to go for Apple, but, you know, sell it off. You know something's about that.
Yeah, if you read the histories of Apple that have come out over time, it's pretty clear that there were two situations where it came very close for Apple to being sold. Once was to Sony, and once was to Sun Microsystem. And in both cases, I believe the stock price for the Sun Microsystem is rumored to have been around $35 a share.
Mm-hmm.
My general feeling is that in both cases, it would have been a case of buying the company for the intellectual property and discontinuing the product lines. It did not look good for Apple in either case.
As I recall, Apple wanted just a little bit too much money than Sun was willing to pay.
Yeah, some of it was that, but also Spindler was insisting that as part of the deal that he would get a seat on the board of directors for both companies. And ultimately, as I've been told, in both cases, it was that that caused both companies to walk.
Mm. Yeah, that's seemingly self-serving.
Yeah. To
sell off the company and put a lot of people out of work, but get yourself a board position. Kind of fits in with his mentality. We were talking yesterday about what life would be like if that had happened and Sun had acquired Apple. Not many people think that Sun would have stayed with the Macintosh, but as you said, you know, folded some of the GUI technology into Sun OS and then later Solaris.
Yeah, I think so. And if you stop and take a look at not only what Apple has done to transform its products and its company and sort of the people that use it. Look around, for instance, look at Google's announcement today and their Pixel phone and how much that looks and acts like an iPhone. And you start understanding just how much of an impact Apple has had on the entire world. So now try to figure out if Apple had been sold to Sun and effectively shut down, what would reality look like today? And I think that that's an interesting question to ponder, even if you're not somebody who lives in the Apple ecosystem.
Yeah. What would we be using as our favorite personal computers? We'd probably be using Windows PCs and not loving it very much.
Yeah, they'd probably still be beige, too.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there was another inflection point that we were talking about, and that was when Gil Amelio, and I think it was the CIO, Helen Hancock, Dr. Helen Hancock, were suddenly realizing that something needed to be done about Apple and saving the company and upgrading the operating system to something that was very serious. I was a Lockheed Martin at the time, and I remember the transition where Lockheed Martin went in and took 4,000 Macintoshes, these are mostly Centrises and Quadras, and put them on roller carts and rolled them out of the offices and brought in PCs with running Windows NT because it checked all the boxes, and Apple sales were in trouble. Mac Week magazine was in trouble. Nobody was advertising. Nobody was selling. And so there was this crisis that we all know about during Gil Amelio's era. And the question was, could you build your own internal operating system to replace Mac OS 9 like Copeland and Gershwin? Or should you acquire something from the outside? Fill us in.
Well, they did go off and they tried to come up with a next generation operating system, and that was Copeland. Copeland was, for much of its life, much more demoware, or even more correctly, PowerPointware. than it was real software. It was an extremely large and complicated project that they went in with IBM on. Ultimately, I think they did some nice things with Copeland and with what was called Pink. I think it was called Pink because the Apple stuff was red and the IBM stuff was white in terms of their code names. And it just wasn't going to come together soon enough. Apple was struggling. Sales were falling. Apple was literally running out of money. And so they decided that they had to go out and try to find a new technology to fix the problems, because they couldn't wait for Copeland to mature. And that's when they turned to Jean-Louis Gasset and his B technology. And there was a lot of talk that went on about buying B and using it as the basis for the next generation. Ultimately, that deal failed. And that's when Gil Amelio turned to Steve and the next technology, next step, and ended up buying the company. And Steve, once he got back in the company, sort of got situated and then set things up to kind of nudge Amelio out the side door. And Steve took over, and that is where we ended up with the beginning of the resurgence with the Bondi Blue Mac.
That's iMac. Right. That's right. Saved the company. Stripped away everything that was not necessary. Got Johnny
Ive. Literally saved
gear.
The company. Yeah. I mean, that product literally saved the company. At the time Steve came on board, I believe that we were down to maybe 90 days worth of cash before we simply started bouncing checks.
Mm-hmm.
And Steve was able to pull it all together, find funding, including from companies like Microsoft,
right.
The infamous Microsoft investment,
right.
Which actually paid Microsoft back rather nicely when you stop and look at the numbers. So it was a good thing for all involved. And then he brought out the iMac in Bondi Blue, and for the first time we had a computer that wasn't beige.
What was interesting about that, I thought, was that Steve realized that Mac OS 10, the derivative from Next OS, the BSD Unix, wasn't ready yet. But he did realize, in concert with Johnny Ive, that style, the feel, the warmth, the touch, the design, the color, the ease of connection to the internet. Remember Jeff Goldblum's There Is No Step 3. Beauty of this iMac, even though it was running Mac OS 9, was sufficient to get people excited, because, you know, Mac OS 9 worked. I didn't have all the bells and whistles, but it worked. And it got people on the internet, and it got people playing with their computers and loving them. And then that bought him time for Mac OS 10.
Exactly. And I think the Bondi Blue iMac is not really recognized for one of Steve's core strengths, which is an understanding that if you look at what Spindler did, he basically went into a pitched battle with Microsoft and had his head handed to him. What Steve did instead was understand that it's possible to change the rules of the game in a way that your competitors can't compete effectively.
Right.
And the Bondi Blue iMac turned style and quality and utility into key selling features versus megahertz or gigahertz and size of RAM and what peripherals are out there. And it created an environment that brought in new classes of people who just wanted to get work done. And it also created an environment that Microsoft really struggled for years to compete in, because they were used to selling to the IT enterprise nerd techno crowd.
Right. And the big thing was purchase authority. You had purchase authority, if you had a credit card in your wallet and you wanted to stand in line on a Saturday morning for an iMac, you could buy it. You didn't have to get any form signed by your IT department.
And the Mac then became the sort of thing an individual was more likely to buy, because they didn't have to muck around on the insides and they could just get their work done.
Yep. And the rest is history. And as we know, in modern times, Steve saved the company through a succession of great products. And then we went on to the iPod and the iPhone. And here we are today. And so one of the things we talked about in the pre-show was the management style of Steve. Because it was up to Steve to save the company, but the management technique you use to resuscitate a company from its deathbed is not the same management technique you use when a company is gloriously successful and in steady to mild growth. And there's been a lot of discussion about that with respect to Tim Cook. And you had some thoughts about Steve Jobs' selection of Tim as his successor.
Well, I worked in Tim's organization for a long time because ultimately I spent a number of years in IS&T, which is the IT organization for Apple, and that ultimately reported up to Tim. And Steve was not an easy person to work for. Steve was not particularly a friendly person to work for. He could be very brutal in his critique, but he was effective. And I think the reason people became very loyal to Steve is that he demanded of others what he demanded of himself. He was one of the hardest working people. He was one of the most critical about himself. And so it wasn't like he was setting a higher bar for those around him than he was setting for his own bar. And tough love was a very necessary thing for Apple in the time when he was trying to run around and fix it. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't always fun and it wasn't always pleasant, but it had to be done and it was long overdue. Tim's a much different person, but Apple is a much different company. It's a much larger and more mature company. The product line is both innovative and evolutionary, and he has brought back a bit of a personality, but he's also brought back sort of a humanistic side to the company that was missing under Steve. And I always felt that Tim was the obvious person to take over for Steve. I was happy when I saw that he was the one who was put into the role. And I think that he has excelled at it. It's not the same company it was under Steve, but I don't believe that the company that Steve built could not have survived without Steve. But the reality is Steve understood that, and he actually put a management team in place that didn't need him once he was gone. And they have proven that Steve made the right choices when he put that management team together.
Interesting perspective. Well, the management team has done really well over the years and grown Apple from a $5 to $6 billion company in annual revenues to about $240 billion a year annual revenue. And yet the management team hasn't really grown that much, nor has Apple spun out any divisions, nor have they given any other senior vice president, you know, divisional authority. And that management structure has worked very well, but it seems to be under some stress lately with respect to the Macintosh, and that's one of the things I wanted to ask you about. You know, it's no secret that a lot of websites have built timetables and Mac recommendations and observations about the long time since the Macs have been updated. Do you sense that we're on the precipice of something exciting and great? Or has Apple perhaps become a little bit overwhelmed and not attending to Macintosh business? What do you think?
I think Apple got itself into a supply chain problem, and it's just taken a while for it to work itself out.
Supply chain with respect to?
Primarily, I think the problem was that there were delays with Intel CPUs to the point where Apple decided to skip a generation, and then the generation after that also delayed. And so, you know, once the train leaves the station, it's rather hard to reroute the individual cars. And so they've had to kind of live with the problems that those decisions made. But now it looks like the Skylake and the Kitty Lake stuff is starting to come out and look okay. Mm-hmm. And if you think about Skylake, there was a problem with Intel Windows stuff where under certain circumstances, I believe the CPU would lock up. And I could well imagine Apple choosing not to ship until they had that fully resolved. So the rumor mills right now say that there's going to be an event sometime in October where the new Macs are going to be announced. And I think that the logjam is going to break. And I think the problem you run into is that there are a lot of technological shifts going on, one of which is going to be the shift to Lightning 3 from the older versions, which is going to allow them to natively drive a 5K.
Thunderbolt 3?
Sorry, Thunderbolt 3. Which will let them drive a 5K monitor, but you can't release the monitor until you have devices that can support it, and you can't release the devices until everything else is ready, and that required Sierra. And so they've kind of had this logjam, and I think that the logjam is about to break. The interesting question to me, because it's pretty well understood, I think, what the basics of the MacBook Pro updates are going to be. But to me, the big question is, how are they going to handle the power users and the heavy developers and the video guys? Because the Mac Pro is a disaster and the Mini is kind of a neglected toy. And I don't know how they're I don't know what their plans are, but I hope even if they don't show product, that they at least explain what they're planning on doing on those.
That's key. I have been writing about how if there's an Apple Macintosh event in October and new MacBook Pros and maybe a modified MacBook Air, we've heard rumors about MacBook Airs being updated with USB-C, and nothing else is said. The Sturm und Drang will continue unabated. So I agree with you. It would be very nice if even if the systems aren't ready yet, Tim Cook were to finish up and say, yeah, and there's some other Macs in the line too besides these MacBooks, and stay tuned. We'd all go, yay!
On the other hand, maybe it's not another Mac, because there have been rumors that the 5K monitors are going to have an external GPU that plugs in through Thunderbolt.
You think they're really going to go through with this 5K monitor standalone after they left us hanging?
I think they're going to go through with the 5K monitor. I don't know if they're going to go through with the external GPUs in it, but I've been thinking about how do you solve the problem of the Mac Pro, because it frankly hasn't been a very good seller.
Yeah. But the problem is that Apple, when they discontinued the Thunderbolt display, said, hey, we recommend you go out and buy another display. So we all went out and bought another display.
Yeah.
And then after a gap, Apple says, well, guess what? You bought another display, but we have a new 5K monitor. You should buy that one now. That's not going to go over very well.
No, but you don't have to replace your monitor until you want to. That's different than telling everyone to go out and buy an iMac and then shipping a new Mac Pro.
Yeah.
What I'm wondering is whether or not it's technically and logistically possible to solve the needs of these high-end users by selling them a MacBook Pro with an external processor box that adds a bunch of capabilities like the external GPU would do. So that you could effectively take your laptop and dock it to another processing engine and make that effective for somebody rather than put somebody in position of owning multiple units. I mean, my optimum right now is I would love to buy a new Mac Mini with iMac 5K capabilities and a MacBook. But I'm probably going to end up with a MacBook Pro of some sort, and I'd really love to be able to buy a smaller, lighter weight one if I could plug in additional power when I'm seating at my desk.
That's an intriguing idea. Get on the airplane with your MacBook Pro and open the lid, do your work. You get back to your office, connect it to a powerful GPU and big display, and continue on. Wow. You heard it here first, folks.
I think there's lots of opportunity there, and with Thunderbolt 3's throughput, I think it's actually a possibility. And it's been clear for a while that Apple's view of the world has been to use the USB and the Thunderbolt buses for connectivity rather than build connections and slots into their computers. And I think with Thunderbolt 3, we're at that point where that's actually practical for most people.
Chuck, we only have a few minutes left, so there's a couple other things I want to get to very briefly. First, do you think Apple might take the Macintosh line to ARM processors down the road in some fashion?
I think it's possible. I would expect it would be fairly easy at the low end, such as an ARM-based MacBook. It gets tougher when you get into the higher end where people expect to be able to use virtualized environments and that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. But I could see a 3 to 5 year transition where part of the product line is running ARM and it slowly takes over the entire market.
That way Apple would be prepping us, which sort of telegraphing their intentions.
I'm not convinced that it will happen, but I think that there are a lot of reasons why it could. And if Intel can't prove that it's got its performance and roadmap delays under control, then I think that that raises the possibility of something like that happening. But it's not something I would lose sleep over, because that would be a 3 to 5 year transition and it would only be part of the Mac product line for the first couple of years of that.
Okay, one last subject. I've had this fantasy for a long time because I have a Synology RAID 5 system, that Apple would someday give us a glorious, what I call Apple Family Server. I just made that name up. That would be kind of like the Synology before drive bays. It would use the glorious software from the, remember the Apple Xserve RAID, which was so beautiful and so well-developed and beautiful GUI and allowed you to monitor and keep track of the health and state of your RAID system. And this RAID system would just sit there on your family network and it would back up everything. And if a drive failed, it wouldn't be like if your time machine dies and you're cooked. You just, you know, hot swap one of the SATA drives and put a new one in and rebuild, and you're still back up and running and you haven't lost any data. And while hot swapping, you know, SATA drives in a RAID 5 system may seem like something terribly geeky compared to a friendly little USB 3 drive, I think Apple could make it work. And I've been sort of having fantasies about that for a long time. And you had some thoughts on that. Tell me.
I think they could do that. I think Apple has kind of indicated that it thinks iCloud is that for them. Mm-hmm. And I know we're not at that point yet, but at the same time, you look at the new Apple file system documents that they've shipped out and are going to be in the, you know, starting to roll out with whatever comes after Sierra. It's pretty clear that they are architecting to allow them to do a next generation time machine that will solve a lot of the current time machine problems. I also think that there's a lot of opportunity there for either Apple to create a cloud-based backup where Time Machine does the backup and then syncs the appropriate pieces out for you so you don't even have to think about it, or possibly create a plug-in type architecture so that a third party like Backblaze could do that.
Cool.
And I think over the next couple of years, the new Apple file system stuff starts to roll out, you're going to see some aspects of that happening. Because I think Time Machine is one of those things that could use a technology upgrade, but I think it's going to require the new file system format to get there.
Right. I've been writing about that for a long time. Time Machine was first brought out a decade ago and hasn't been seriously upgraded since. And boy, I'm really looking forward to what Apple can do with APFS. That's going to be neat. We have covered a huge amount of ground here, and it's been delightful chatting with you. This has been a fantastic discussion. I really appreciate hearing your insights. So we're going to have to wrap it up. Chuck, tell the listeners how they can contact you if they wish.
You can find me, probably the easiest thing is on Twitter at @CHUQ. You can catch me on my blog, which is www.chuqui.com. And I'm all over the place in other areas. I've just launched a new podcast called Occam's Fire Axe. You can get details of that off of my website. It's basically a book review podcast that I try to put out every 2 weeks. And other than that, I just kind of hang out and talk to people where I find interesting people to talk to.
Cool. Well, I'll put all those in the show notes. So thanks again, Chuck. It's been delightful. I'm really glad you were able to join us on the show. Your insights have been spectacular. Folks, I'm glad. Go ahead.
I've had a great time, and thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And folks, I'm glad you came by and joined us. I hope you enjoyed the show. We'll see you next week on the Mac Observer's Background Mode.